So tonight, I want to talk about the higher jhanas, jhanas 5, 6, 7, and 8. There's a simile that's given in the Visuddhimagga for the first four jhanas. You're lost in the desert, and you don't have any water. And you come over a little rise, and you see in the distance what looks like palm trees. You begin to get excited, and you head towards those palm trees, and they don't turn into a mirage, and it might be an oasis, and you're beginning to get really excited, and you come near to it, and you meet people, they have wet hair, they have bundles of wet clothing, it is an oasis, you get really excited, first jhana. You come to the oasis, it's beautiful, there's all this water, you are so happy, second jhana. You drink the water, you get in, you cool off, you get cleaned up, you get out, you are satisfied, third jhana. And then you lie down in the shade of a tree and have a rest, fourth jhana. The simile is actually a very good description of what it's like to go through the first four jhanas, from the excitement to the happiness to the satisfaction to the state of deep rest. In fact, the fourth jhana can be so restful that when you come out of a really good fourth jhana, it may feel as though you had a nap, except you know you weren't asleep. It is that recharging for the mind. We spend our days thinking, 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 and our nights either dreaming, 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 or completely oblivious. And in the fourth jhana, you have a chance to be alert and nothing much going on, and that's quite restful. These first four jhanas are sometimes referred to as the rupa jhanas. Rupa means material. Often they're called the fine material jhanas. This is in contrast to the next four, which are sometimes called the immaterial jhanas. Actually, in the suttas, you have the four jhanas and you have the four immaterial states. What we call jhanas 5, 6, 7, and 8 are just immaterial states. It's only later that they were put into a sequence of eight jhanas. It makes sense. It's a handy way to discuss all eight states. But they're immaterial in the sense that they are nothing like you've experienced in the material world, whereas those first four jhanas, rapture, happiness, contentment, quiet stillness, we do experience from time to time in the material world. These higher jhanas have names. The first four are just simply first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. But these immaterial states do have names. I'll read you what it has to say. Here, by passing entirely beyond bodily sensations, by the disappearance of all sense of resistance, and by non-attraction to the perception of diversity, seeing that space is limitless, one reaches and remains in the realm of limitless space. So the fifth jhana is the realm of limitless space. Sometimes you see it referred to as the sphere of limitless space. It just means realm. Doesn't mean it's round, okay? Or the sphere of infinite space. But at the time of the Buddha, they didn't have the concept of zero. I sort of doubt they had the concept of infinity. So perhaps limitless or boundless is more accurate. So by passing entirely beyond bodily sensations, these are states of concentration that are deep enough that you're no longer paying any attention to your body. You're pretty far out there. And then by the disappearance of all sense of resistance and by non-attraction to the perception of diversity. Okay, I should give you the instructions, because then that'll make sense. All right, so if you're in the fourth jhana, you may find yourself a bit slumped over. This is quite common. Your energy is just so down that, yeah, you're physically down as well. If that's the case, yeah, get yourself a little more upright. And then what Ayakema told me was get in touch with the boundaries of my being and expand them to fill the room. And after I got that settled, expand them to fill the building. And then the retreat center. And then just keep expanding till I hit the horizon and keep going. So at first, there's the room, the building, the retreat center, the horizon. These are perceptions of diversity. When I hit the horizon, though, she said, just keep going. And there's no more paying attention to anything. It's not like you're passing clouds or the moon or Mars or Jupiter or anything like that. You're just expanding. Also, the expanding needs to go without any sense of resistance. If you're doing the expanding and it gets stuck, you're going to have to push through it. It just needs to go smoothly. The expansion doesn't have to be in all directions. That's too complex, actually. I would say expand in two directions. You can move your arms symmetrically. So you can go out to the sides. You can go up in front. You can go up and out. That's pretty common. But just, you know, find a way to expand and just go with that. Keep your attention on the sense of outward expansion, out on the edges of it. If you can do so, eventually, a vast empty space will appear before you. It just opens up. That's the fifth jhana. The expansion is only the mechanism for generating the fifth jhana. It's when the vast space appears that you're actually at the fifth jhana. Put your attention on the spaciousness of that space. Now, as I said, Ayakema told me to expand the boundaries of my being. It turns out it doesn't matter what you expand. The commentaries say that you're to expand the nimitta, the circle of light, but you're probably not getting a nimitta. I had one student who took an imaginary balloon and just blew it up bigger, 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 bigger until it popped and there was a space. She was also the student that took an imaginary flashlight and followed the beam of light further, 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 further until it illuminated the space. I've had people talk about riding elevators or riding rocket ships. Whatever you can do to get your mind out there limitlessly, just keep going and go nice and smoothly. When the space appears, it could be off-white or light gray. It could be black, like outer space. But if it's black, it's not going to have stars and galaxies and all that stuff in it. Remember, you're beyond the perception of diversity. It's just a big black space. Very important. When doing the expansion, don't look for the space. You have to stay concentrated on the expansion. And if you're looking for the space, you're not concentrated on the expansion. Don't worry. When the space appears, you'll know it. All right? And when it does, you drop the sense of expansion and focus on the space. In the fifth jhana, there's still an observer, a very tiny observer, and the vast space before the observer. When the fifth jhana is really strong, the space is below and above and behind. But when you first start getting it, maybe it's only in front of you. And you may not even notice that there's an observer. It may be only after you come out of it that you realize, oh yeah, it was like a point of observation or something. The fifth jhana is sort of like you're walking across the Arizona desert and you come to the Grand Canyon. I mean, it's just big space opens up in front of you, only there's no bottom and there's no other side. It's just a giant space. What you want to do is be able to maintain this for 5 to 10 minutes, right? So you do the expansion, the space appears, you keep your attention on the space, and just maintain the jhana for an extended period of time. It's subtle. It's more subtle than the previous ones. And actually, the transition from the fourth jhana to the fifth jhana is quite difficult. It's probably the most difficult transition of all, even more difficult than 0 to 1. But it's doable, provided you've got a good fourth jhana. Don't rush to get to number 5. Too often on retreats, I have people rushing so they can experience all the jhanas, and then when they go home, they can't get back to any of them because they didn't learn them really well. Much better to learn a few jhanas really well than rush to try and get them all. But assuming you get to the fifth jhana and can sustain it, then by passing entirely beyond the realm of limitless space, seeing that consciousness is limitless, one reaches and remains in the realm of limitless consciousness. The instructions are getting a bit sparse. Okay. So, you're sitting there experiencing this giant space. You can't be aware of a limitless space with a limited awareness. You can't be conscious of an infinite space with a finite consciousness. Your consciousness has to be as big as the space. To move to the sixth, the trick is to turn your attention from the space back to your consciousness of the space. Become aware of your awareness of the space. Become conscious of your consciousness of the space. It's a turning back. If you do it right, it feels like you become absorbed into the space and now you are this limitless consciousness. For people that are visual, not much shows up at all. Maybe kind of dark. People that aren't visual, yeah, you just know your mind is really big. Stay focused on how big your mind is. When you start practicing the sixth jhana for the first time, you may find that there's not a whole lot of difference between the fifth and the sixth. A bit, but it doesn't seem all that different. As you get more skilled in the fifth and the sixth, then they start to seem actually quite different. If you come from a spiritual tradition where the goal of the spiritual life is union with some Atman or higher self or the universe or something, you may think, if you stumble into the sixth jhana, that you've done what you needed to do. I mean, right? There's this infinite mind and it's yours and you're there. No, sorry. You're just having an experience that you interpret as having an infinite mind, an infinite consciousness. Sometimes, if you get the sixth jhana really strong, it may seem as though there are other consciousnesses within that consciousness. A few little consciousness over here, a few little consciousness over there. It's not like you can read the minds of the other people in the room or anything. It just sort of feels like there's some other consciousnesses in there. I've only had that experience maybe, I don't know, half dozen times. So it doesn't occur very often. It only occurs when, yeah, I get a really, really good limitless consciousness. If it shows up, that's what it's about. So now you're hanging out with this limitless consciousness. Get good enough so that you can stay there for 10 to 15 minutes. Then and by passing entirely beyond the realm of limitless consciousness, seeing that there is no thing, one reaches and remains in the realm of no thingness, nothingness. Okay, so you've got this limitless consciousness, this huge consciousness. What is it conscious of? Well, the sense of space is actually long gone. And when you look, it's not conscious of anything. It's conscious of no thing, right? Put your attention on the no thingness, the nothingness. At first, it may seem like there's a sort of a small nothing in front of your face. Okay, stay with the nothing, and it gets to be a bigger nothing and a little bigger and bigger still, and yeah, it's nothing. It's sort of like you go down into the basement and you hit the light switch and it doesn't work and you're trying to see what's down there. And you can tell there's nothing right in front of you. And the more you look, well, there's nothing over there and there's nothing over here. Why, there's nothing down here at all. This is what the entry into the seventh jhana is like. If you're visual, the seventh jhana may show up in one of two ways. Most commonly, it shows up as dark, like black, deep purple, very dark blue, something like that. It's just nothing. Or it might show up, well, remember on the old TV, if you turned it to where there wasn't a station, you got the black and white static. Imagine black and black static. Okay, it's just this sort of sense of movement. There's nothing there, but there's this movement that's happening. Or if you're not a visual person, you may not get any visual sense at all. But you know there's just nothing. Stay focused on the sense of nothing. People who stumble into this state accidentally often get quite freaked out. I've had a number of people come on retreat with me. They were practicing, say, on the three-month course at IMS, and just meditating away, doing their Vipassana, and they fell into the void. There was nothing. It was terrifying. They went running to the teacher, and the teacher gets them calmed down, tells them to take a shower, eat some food, maybe not meditate for a couple days. They come on my retreat, and they say, can I tell you about something that happened to me? I say, yeah, and they tell me, and I go, well, sounds like the seventh jhana. I don't know what it was, but it was really scary. No, it's not scary. You just didn't know what was going on. So then they start learning the jhanas, and eventually they get number six, and they come to an interview, and I say to them, okay, now here are the instructions for number seven. I'm not sure I want to go back there. No, it'll be fine. Go try. Go see. So I give them the instructions, and they go, and yeah, they come back to the next interview going, yeah, that's exactly where I was, only this time it wasn't scary. The only reason it was frightening was because they didn't know what it was. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's a really great place to hang out. There's nothing to bother you. It's by far my favorite jhana. It's a great place. Now, the nothing is not the same as the emptiness that's talked about in the Mahayana tradition. That emptiness means empty of inherent existence. It means that, well, it's the same that everything is dependently arisen due to other things. Streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. Okay? That's what that emptiness is talking about. This is like you get the cookie jar and you take the top off and there's nothing. Right? It's just nothing. Or like, let's say while you're asleep tonight, Somebody comes into this room and they take everything away. All the chairs, all the mats, table, Buddha statue, flowers, everything. You come back tomorrow morning and you open the door and there's nothing here. That's what the nothing is, all right? It's just there's nothing to be found. Hang out in the seventh jhana long enough to get really stable there. Actually, hang out past long enough to get really stable. The eighth jhana is quite subtle. You're going to need a good seventh. You're going to need a really good nothing. All right? And by passing entirely beyond the sphere of no thingness, one reaches and remains in the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. So the eighth jhana is called the sphere or realm of neither perception nor non-perception. The word perception is a translation of sanya, and sanya is our ability to name things, to identify them. Can you see a picture of a woman? Right? Everybody see the picture of a woman. Right? There's no woman here. It's just black and white shapes. The woman is in your mind. Right? You take the black and white shapes and convert them into a woman. You know, if I show it to you like this and I say, see the woman, and you're like, wait a second, what? Right? Perception is our capacity to take colored shapes and convert them into some object. It's easiest to see this with a painting. You might try looking at one of the paintings around here. You know, there's lots of paintings of boats and so forth. And it's just colored shapes. There's no boats, no wharf. It's just colored shapes. But we make boats out of it. That's what's meant by sanya, perception, the ability to name things or identify things. So the eighth jhana is neither naming nor not naming, neither identifying nor not identifying. I don't guess that helps a lot. It's a very subtle state. It's a state that has no characteristics by which you can describe it. But you can at least recognize that you're in a state that has no characteristics by which you can describe it. And you can stay in this state that has no characteristics by which you can describe it. That's about the best way I can describe it. The good news is, if you've got a really good seventh jhana, a really good nothing, it's fairly easy to find number eight. You've probably got a big nothing if you got a good seven, right? Just let the nothing collapse and come to rest in front of your face and see if your mind will go into a state that you can't describe, but it'll stay there. If so, probably the eighth jhana. The eighth jhana is very subtle. It was quite a while before I ever got into it and could stay for as long as I wanted. Most of the others I got pretty good at. You know, I wanted to stay 30 minutes, I could stay 30 minutes. But the eighth, yeah. In any of the jhanas, there's the primary factor, say the contentment of the third jhana, and your one-pointedness on it. You might get a little distracted, right? Start losing your one-pointedness. The contentment's going to start fading, but if you get back in time, it'll come back. It's not like it's gone, right? It just sort of starts to fade out, but you come back, right? It's there. You can even do this with the seventh jhana. Now, you can't be gone very long because it's going to fade much faster, but you can wobble a little bit. In the eighth jhana, maybe you have time for one simple sentence, as long as it doesn't contain the words I, me, or mine, right? This is a fragile state. I couldn't tell you the number of times I've gotten into the eighth jhana. Yeah, really got it this time. And then the next thing I know, I find myself in the middle of some paragraph of distraction. It's like, where'd the eighth jhana go? Not a trace of it left, just gone. So I have to go back to seven or maybe even back to five and then work my way back up there to it. These are the so-called higher jhanas, the immaterial jhanas. They seem to generate a mind that's even more concentrated, clearer, sharper, brighter, more malleable, more wieldy, more given to imperturbability. I certainly find that coming out of four, my insight practices go better because my mind is really stable. Coming out of eight, yeah, it's even better. My mind is really quiet. In fact, sometimes coming out of eight, my mind is so quiet that not much is going on. If, for example, I was going to do the five daily reflections, it's better to go back to seven, I find, and then come out of seven and start doing the reflections. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 7, and then do the reflections. But if I'm going to do the body scan, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and I don't have to think, I just have to move my attention, and that works just fine. There is a state that in modern times is sometimes called the ninth jhana. It's never called that in the suttas, although it is referred to. In the suttas, it's called the cessation of feeling and perception. Nirodha Vedana Sanya, or something like that. It's a state of suspended animation, really. You may have heard about yogis in India. They dig a pit, and they put them in a coffin, they put them in the pit, they cover it over. A week later, they dig them up, and they're all fine. They're putting themselves into this state of Nirodha, this so-called ninth jhana, this state of cessation. It is said that if you are at this third stage of awakening, or fully awakened, you can stay in this state for up to a week. That's been misinterpreted, that you can only get into it if you're at the third or fourth state, but that doesn't seem to be the case. If you're at the third or fourth stage, you have the capacity to stay for up to a week, apparently. But other people can stay for shorter periods of time. There's a documentary movie called Shortcut to Nirvana, which is a documentary of the Kumbh Mela Festival held in India in 2001. It's a pretty big festival. I think only about 20 million people came. So imagine everybody in Sweden going to a festival. Yeah, it was more people than that. It's a very interesting documentary, highly recommended. It's got the Dalai Lama, it's got all these weird Hindu ascetics and so forth. Very entertaining, very interesting. But one of the scenes, they dig a big pit, and this Japanese woman climbs down a ladder, and then they pull out the ladder, and they put roofing tin over the pit, and then they cover it with dirt. End of scene. 3 days later, they come back, they sweep away the dirt, they remove the roofing tin, they put the ladder back down, and she climbs out all happy. I suspect that she was in the state of Nirodha. I mean, yeah, that's the way I'd want to spend 3 days in a pit. The other thing I can tell you about it, I was in Thailand for Thai New Year's 1 year. Thai New Year's is in April, which is the end of the hot season and the beginning of the rainy season. At that time, the Thais do their spring cleaning. And any Thai Buddhist family would have an altar in their house, and they would wash the Buddha statue. And the custom developed that they would take some of the water that they use for washing the Buddha statue, and then they would sprinkle that on the hands of their elders to salute their Buddha nature. Well, in modern times, the sprinkling has gotten a bit out of hand, and everybody in the country is throwing buckets of water on everybody else in the country. It's quite a participatory festival. You step out of the door of your guest house and you're greeted with a bucket of water. It's, you know, like 35, 40 degrees out, so it's not a problem. So I was in Chiang Mai, which is really the center of the festival, and on the first morning I go down to the main square. It's a pretty chaotic scene. They've set up these water spigots along the main street there, and if you put in a 1 baht coin, then out comes some water. And the Thais have got big barrels there. And, of course, they see me coming, and they go, 1 baht, 1 baht. All right, so I put my 1 baht in. Out comes the water. And, of course, I can get some water to get the people that are getting me, right? And people are throwing water at each other and passing cars in the windows of the buses. Any motorcycle comes along. I mean, it's chaos. And there at the main square, off to one side, not quite in the middle of the chaos, they had built a little pavilion. And sitting in this pavilion was a monk in meditation. He was in full lotus. His eyes were downcast and open, not blinking. And he had the most serene look on his face I have ever seen. It was quite impressive. I mean, to be sitting there with all this chaos going on around him and obviously not disturbed. He was there when the parade came through that morning. He was there when the other parade came through that afternoon. He was there that night when they had the first round of the beauty pageant about 30 meters away. He was there the second morning. He was there the second afternoon. He was there that night when they had the second round of the beauty pageant. He was there the third morning. He looked a little tired, serenely tired. He was there that afternoon when the biggest parade of all came by. He was there that night when they had the finals of the beauty pageant. He was gone the next day. He had to be in the state of Nirodha. There's no way to sit there in the midst of all this chaos and not be disturbed. The other thing I can tell you about the state of Nirodha, I read a article by Rod Bucknell a few years ago. He's a scholar who lives in Queensland, Australia. And in his article, he said that the jhanas described in the suttas are not the same as the jhanas described in the Visuddhimagga, the commentary from 800 or 900 years later. And furthermore, that's what's described in the Visuddhimagga actually is states of Nirodha, of cessation, that you basically go through the 8 jhanas of the suttas to get to the first jhana of the state of Nirodha in the Visuddhimagga. Well, I thought that was kind of interesting, and it did sort of match what was described in the Visuddhimagga. And then I went on retreat with Pao Auk, first in 2006, I didn't get anywhere near his jhanas. And then in 2011, I had 2.5 months on retreat before he showed up, and then he was there for 4 months. And eventually, I was getting really concentrated. I was getting the nimitta, the circle of light that you're supposed to get when you're super concentrated. And then eventually, one day, I just absorbed into the nimitta. I was gone. There was only the nimitta. There was no body. There were no sounds. And there was no passage of time. It's like, hey, that nimitta is pretty good. And then it was 45 minutes later. I'm guessing 45 minutes. As best I could tell, that's how long I was gone. It was a state of complete absorption. And while I was in it, there were no feelings and no perceptions. It was just like the description of the cessation of feeling and perception. I had an interview with Powell the next day and described it to him. And he said, good, do for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. Okay. I had an interview with a French Canadian monk the day after that, and he had been sitting in on the interview I had with Powell, and he confirmed it was indeed the first jhana, the first Visuddhimagga jhana, although he didn't say Visuddhimagga jhana. But it was a state of complete absorption. Now, I never got back there. I could set up the same initial conditions, I could get the same nice nimitta. And the first time I got that, it was like, okay, I'm going to watch what happens. Well, no, you can't watch what happens, right? And I quickly realized, no, I have to not watch what happens. Yeah, right. Don't think of a pink elephant, right? Never got back there. Got really concentrated, okay? Got into the jhanas that I learned from Ayakema really deeply, but never got back to that state of cessation. But it is an accessible state, and you're just gone. And then it's sometime later. So that's the so-called ninth jhana. I would say get the first eight, right? Don't worry about the ninth one. It's actually not terribly useful. You're not going to get any insight because nothing's happening. I mean, it might be useful if you have to go to the dentist or something, but other than that, I'd say let it go. So these are the higher jhanas. Any questions?
Are you very tired often?
Was I very tired after being in the
jhanas?
If you're working to learn the jhanas, it can make you very tired. Yeah. It's not easy. You're really working your mind pretty strenuously. Most people report that, yeah, okay, when I go on retreat, I need less sleep, but they come to me and they say, yeah, I still need a lot of sleep when I'm doing jhana practice. Yeah, so it can be quite tiring. Once you're skilled at it, it's not so tiring because you know what you're doing. It's just like any skill. When you're first trying to do it, it's really difficult and you waste a lot of energy doing things you don't need to do. Once you actually get good at it, then, yeah, it's not so tiring.
Not so.
Right. But it's a little tiring, yeah.
So the state of cessation of feeling and perception is the first Visuddhi jhana. How do you imagine the succeeding one?
Right. If the first Visuddhimagga jhana is the state of feeling and perception, what are the others? Well, since I never got there, I don't know. The way that you know where you are, all right, so I had this state of cessation. When you come out, you're to look at your heart center here. I actually earlier had pointed to here when I was talking with Powell, the center of my chest, and he goes, no, here, off to the side. Okay, right. So when you come out, you're supposed to look there, and you can see a reflection of the nimitta. And you can see the factors of the jhana you just had, meaning that you ought to be able to see vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata, the last one being one-pointedness. All right, so I came out, and it was like, oh, that was cool. Oh, I'm supposed to look. So I look. If you've had your eyes closed for a long time, and then you look down, there's a little bit of light leakage where your eyes are, and so it seems to be white. Oh, okay, that's the reflection of the nimitta, I assume, right? And when I looked down, this wave of really sweet piti sukha came over me. Okay, yeah, there's the piti sukha. All right, so I look straight ahead again, and I look again. Could I see the initial attention on the meditation object? Oh, yeah, I remember very clearly. Going, put your attention on the nimitta. Okay, so now look again. Can I see the sustained attention? Well, yeah, that's all there was. And could I see the one-pointedness of mind? Yep, most assuredly I had a very one-pointed mind. Therefore, it was the first jhana. I assume you get the same state, probably deeper, And when you look, you just get the piti and sukha and one-pointedness. The descriptions that I read, it's all about looking after you come out and you see something different, rather than describing what the actual experience is. Now, when I'm teaching you the jhanas, I'm saying go 1, 2, 3, 4. Go to access 1, 2, 3, 4. Then the Visuddhimagga jhanas, you go to access 1, access 2, access 3, access 4. And that back to access is when you're looking to see where you were. So it seems to have something to do with what you do when you come out of this state of Nirodha. And that's the best I can tell you.
I don't know exactly how to raise the question, but it's around a seemingly contradiction that on one hand, you in the introduction or instructions say the jhanas comes to you, which means meaning, and on the other hand, also the other day and also today, you say, do this, do this, do this.
Okay.
Is it possible to comment upon this?
Yes. Can I comment upon, don't do anything, the jhana will come find you, and I'm telling you, do this, do this, do this. Okay. The things I'm telling you to do are to set up the conditions so the jhana arises. Okay? So do put your attention on the breathing. Do bring it back when it goes away. Do recognize when you're at access. Do put your attention on the pleasant sensation, and now you don't have to do anything. The jhana comes. All right? You've got the first jhana, you want the second one. Do take a deep breath and let it out, and then the second jhana comes. All right? So there's a bit of doing to establish the conditions out of which the jhana arises. All right? But you're not actually doing the jhana. You're doing the expansion. But the expansion is not the jhana. The jhana just appears. The infinite space just appears. Right? And then you do put your attention on the space. And even for the eighth one, you just let the nothing collapse and you put your attention in front of you and you see what happens. So there is something to do, but it's about shifting your attention mostly, rather than trying to make something happen. And you shift your attention and then you wait and the jhana appears. What did they see when I was doing the scientific experiments on jhanas 5, 6, 7, and 8? We only have one run in an fMRI of jhana 5. The first place I did fMRI runs, they usually did fMRI for 10 minutes, which is not time enough to go through the jhanas. So they needed to set it for longer runs, like for 45 minutes. But nobody really knew how to do that very well. Only one time did we get enough data so that I got as far as the fifth jhana. I continued to be in that machine with it pounding away and went to 6 and 7 and 8, but they didn't get any pictures. So we did get a picture of 5. And all that I know is it looked different from the others. Okay, we do have some EEG pictures. And again, each of the jhanas 5, 6, 7, 8 looks different from 1, 2, 3, 4 and different from each other. 5, 6, 7, and 8 looked more similar to each other than, say, 1, 2, 3, 4 did. I don't remember anything about activity in the nucleus accumbens or in the left prefrontal cortex. When I saw that data, I wasn't aware to look in those areas and so forth. So basically, they have some data, but nobody's really analyzed it. The only analysis that's really been done is on 1, 2, 3, and 4, except for a little bit that I saw one time back in, 2005, and I don't remember what it looked like. Somebody in the back have a question?
Yeah. Let's say you're in state 6 or 7 or any of the higher ones.
Mm-hmm.
Someone opens the door and it goes click. What do you get of that in your state?
Okay. So if you're in one of the higher jhanas and somebody opens the door and then it closes with a click, what do you experience? You might not notice the click, right? You're there, and the sound enters your ear, and you're just not paying attention to it, right? It's just far enough away that you don't notice it. It's going to depend on the strength of your concentration and how loud the click is, right? So if the click is pretty quiet and your concentration is pretty good, you're just not going to notice it. If the click is quite loud, your concentration's medium, then yeah, maybe you sort of hear it, but it doesn't really register or anything. It's just like, eh. If the sound is quite loud, it might actually knock you out. When I learned jhanas 6, 7, and 8, I was on a month-long retreat with Ayakema, and this was in Oakland, California, in an urban setting. And it was right before the 4th of July, meaning there were lots of firecrackers. So you'd be meditating away, and suddenly there would be all this noise. Because, it wasn't too far to where, there was projects and people doing things and so forth. And I remember being there in the 8th jhana, and it was pretty good, and I had it going really well. And somebody set off a very loud firecracker pretty close by. And it was like it blew up the 8th jhana. There was just no trace of it. It was just gone. The noise was louder than my concentration, and it just blew me right out of it. So I had to go back to 7 or something and get it going and then come back to 8. So it's going to depend on how loud the noise is and how good your concentration is. If your concentration is really good, then you won't hear the sound at all. If the sound is really loud and your concentration isn't good enough, then it could even knock you out of the jhana.
And the same goes for body sensations?
Right. The same does go for the body sensations. If you have, say, a mild pain somewhere in your body, you may not even notice it at all. But if it starts getting stronger and stronger, it may suddenly start pulling your attention and then pull you out of the jhana. I used to meditate with James Beres in the basement of a church. And I'd come in the wintertime, it's cold outside, come in, it felt a little warmer, meditate. When he rang the bell, come out of the jhanas, and then only notice how cold it was in the basement of that church. Because my concentration was so good in the jhanas, I just hadn't noticed the temperature. And I'd come out and I'd go, wow, it's cold tonight. So yeah.
You're in a jhana and you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go back one step, or do you go back several steps?
If you're in a jhana and you lose it, what do you do? I would say, see, can you go right back into that jhana? Right? You may be able to come right back to it. If you can't immediately come back to it, go back to the previous one. So if you're in 4 and you lose it, and you can't find the quiet stillness right quick, then go back up to the contentment. You often can just sort of reach up to the previous jhana, get yourself settled in that, and then come back to the one that you lost.
I have a question about the simile
mm-hmm.
of the 3rd jhana.
Mm-hmm.
Where they've spoken about the lotuses and the colors of the lotuses.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot recollect ever seeing a photo of a blue lotus. Wasn't the color blue and white and red?
The colors are blue, white, and red.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the significance of that?
What is the significance of the colors of the lotuses? That's how the translator translates those words. Okay? So the words aren't blue, white, and red lotuses. It's, well, Pundarika is white lotus, okay, and I don't know the words for the others, all right? So the translator just puts white lotuses, and there are apparently blue lotuses, okay? So it's three different varieties of lotuses. I saw a lotus in Japan that was sort of gray-green, and it was at a monastery, and it was really interesting because you could go up to it and poke it, push it underwater, and it would come up, and all the water would run off. None of the water would stick to it. You could sort of play with it and so forth. But it was sort of a gray-green color. So, yeah, apparently there are quite a number of varieties of lotuses, and this is just simply saying one variety, another variety, or a third variety. And I presume that's the most common varieties that grew in India at that time.
You tell us what to do to go to the next jhana. For example, from the first one, you take a deep breath,
mm-hmm.
and then you come into the second jhana.
Right.
But then when you say that we can go back, is there nothing you can do to go back?
Yeah, so what are the instructions for going back? Basically, remember what the previous jhana felt like. Okay, so if you're in four, all right, the previous felt like contentment. Can you remember what the feeling of contentment was? If you can, you'll just pop right back up into three. It's actually much easier to go back than it is to come down to the deeper ones. So you're in four, you remember the contentment, and there you are. So you're hanging out in the contentment. Now, to go to the second one, you want happiness. So you can crank the contentment to where it's really content, like really, really content. And it turns into happiness and you pop up. And then to get to the first, you make the happiness really happy, like really, really happy. And then here comes the piti. So those are pretty easy transitions. From, say, the eighth back to the seventh, you just remember what nothing was like. And then it appears and then it stabilizes. To go back to six, it's sort of remembering what was it like to have a big mind. And hopefully it reappears. You're just sort of touching back into the memory of it. And then back to five. From six to five is usually pretty easy because you're already well expanded, so let go of the sense of mind and just look at the space and it'll reappear. From five to four, it's quite easy. Just let everything drop down again and there you are. That's probably the easiest transition back.
I read this book by Ajahn Brahm. He teaches a 10-day retreats or something. And in that book he said that maybe 30% of the yogis got nimitta in 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds really extraordinary. I don't know.
Yeah.
What your thoughts on that is.
Yeah, so do 30% of the yogis on Ajahn Brahm's get a nimitta in 10 days? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'd say go on retreat with him and find out.
Yeah, I don't want to be disrespectful, but...
Yeah, I mean... to get a really good nimitta to work with took me about 3 months. Okay, so maybe I'm slow, right? Or maybe he has a different way of teaching or something. Now, I have had students that get a nimitta, they're just starting to meditate and they're starting to get a nimitta right away. So it varies from person to person as to how likely they are to actually start seeing a nimitta. So maybe 30% of the people that live in Western Australia have genetic predispositions to seeing nimittas. I have no idea. Yeah, I just don't know. I know that for me, it took about 3 months of practice to get a really good nimitta.
How do you know how long time you are staying in the jhana?
You just guess.
Yes.
Yeah, I say 5 to 10 to 15 minutes, which means stay there for a while. Because, your time sense is all messed up. And you know, all right, I've been here a little while. I could stay longer, but that's really about all you know. Yeah.
Just to sort out things. So we have on the one side the Visuddhi jhanas,
mm-hmm.
and on the other side Ayaha Kimas jhanas, and then in contrast to the canonical jhanas. I mean, I guess the method you're teaching is a lighter version of the canonical jhanas. Do you have a name for this? The jhanas?
I just refer to them as the Sutta jhanas.
They're different than the Sutta jhanas, wouldn't they?
I would say the only difference is the depth of concentration. In other words, the experience is the same. But
do you have a name for distinguishing?
I just refer to it as the Sutta jhanas. So you could say, I mean, people have accused me of teaching jhana light. Okay, so the light jhanas.
The light Sutta jhanas.
Yeah. But, yeah. My understanding is that what Ayakema was teaching was basically what's found in the suttas, but you probably weren't going to be able to crank your concentration that deeply unless you got really skilled at it, right? In talking with a number of students that have tried to crank up the concentration, yeah, if they go on a longer retreat, they can crank it up to where it does match what's in the suttas, which is what I found for myself. So it's not a matter of doing something different. It's a matter of just doing the same thing with deeper concentration. Whereas the Visuddhi Magga jhanas seem to be, yes, a completely different thing. I made a presentation one time of all of the jhanas that I'd ever heard of. Okay, so there's the eight jhanas, or the four jhanas and the four immaterial states in the suttas. And then there's the nine jhanas in the Abhidhamma. And then there's the eight jhanas in the Visuddhimagga. And then there's the Vipassana jhanas and the Pure Land jhanas and the ninth jhana. And I think at one point I'd managed to enumerate over 30 different states that were called jhanas. So yeah, there's a lot of confusion out there. But basically, we could say they're the Sutta jhanas, the Abhidhamma jhanas, which aren't that different, and then the Visuddhimagga jhanas, which are quite different.
Is the nimitta the same for everybody?
Is the nimitta the same for everybody? Apparently, it's similar, but not the same. The ideal nimitta is just a circle of white light. Okay, but some people get a little golden color in it, or maybe some, it's not a perfect circle, there's little indentations on the edge or things in it. Some people get not a visual nimitta, but a tactile nimitta, and I don't know how that works at all. But let's say that a visual nimitta seems to be fairly similar, but not always identical.
You talked about some student that fallen down to the void.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really have to follow the steps to enter jhana?
Do you have to follow the steps to enter the jhanas? Or can you enter the jhanas out of order? Yes, you can enter the jhanas out of order. If you have sufficient concentration and you turn your mind towards something that is somewhat like one of the jhanas, then you're likely to slide into a jhana. In chaos theory, they talk about strange attractors. There are certain mathematical functions that seem to be fairly stable. If you have another mathematical function that is similar to one of these strange attractors, often as you run more numbers through it, it tends to become one of these strange attractors. It starts out a little differently, but then as the numbers get higher, it looks just like the strange attractor. It just tends to go like that. I'm guessing, and this is just guessing, that the jhanas are like strange attractors. They're a pattern in the brain, okay, a neurological pathway, set of neurons that are firing, that if you get close to that pattern, it just seems to slide into that pattern. I say this because people come and they say to me, can I tell you about something that happened to me? And the most likely thing they're going to describe is one of the jhanas. They might describe an out-of-body experience, which is something really different, or they're going to describe something I never heard of before. Okay, it's not two people coming to describe some concentration state that's the same that's not a jhana. Every one of them is really different. But the common stuff is always the jhanas, and that's by far the most common. So it would appear that if you have sufficient concentration and you feel contented, you'll just go into the third jhana. Or I remember meditating one time and an airplane flew over. And it was pretty concentrated, and I just started following the sound of the airplane. And poof, there was the fifth jhana. Infinite space opened up. I didn't try for the fifth jhana or anything, but I was concentrated and then just started following the airplane sound, and it appeared. So, yes, they do come out of order. I would say the frequency that people stumble in, most likely to go to the first, then the second, then the fourth, then the third, then the fifth, seventh, sixth, and eighth. And yes, I have had occasionally people who have stumbled into all eight jhanas. I remember one of the first people, you know, I'm teaching this course and the guy's getting the jhanas really, really quickly. And finally, when he gets the eighth one, he tells me he'd been in all of them before. He didn't know they were jhanas, but he had stumbled in. He'd been practicing for 20 years. And so he had stumbled into all these states. I just was helping him sort out what came first. Sometimes when people are learning the jhanas, they might get them out of order. They're going 1, 2, 4. They missed number 3. Or 1, 3, 4. They missed number 2. Or they're trying to go from 4 to 5 and they wind up at 7. So these sort of things happen. Or they're trying to go from 5 to 6 and they wind up going 5 to 7. Those are fairly common skips that take place.
Do you have a metaphysical conception of these jhanas? I mean, what's the meaning of it? Is it primordial consciousness? Or is it time consciousness we experience when we die, when the consciousness is transformed from one state to another station of existence? What is it?
What are the jhanas? I would say they are mental states that the human brain, human mind, easily generates. And I'm not going to go into metaphysical speculations of they correspond to other realms or anything else. I think it's...
Why do we create them?
Because our brains are wired.
Yeah, why?
Well, I don't know why. Evolution probably produced these as a side effect of what's going on. I can't see the jhanas as an advantage for survival. But there's a lot of things that are part of our genetic makeup that are just side effects of other things that are going on. I mean, the one that I keep being aware of is that the drainage hole for my lower sinuses is at the top. Now, that has no advantage for survival. In fact, it's actually a disadvantage. Unless, of course, you walk around with your head like this, in which case it works just fine. Right? Back before we got upright, having the drainage hole where it is fine. So having the drainage hole in the wrong place, it evolved like that, and it's just left over. So what's going on in our brains so that we do this? I don't know.
The immaterial jhanas are not dependent upon the brain, from matter?
I would say they are.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
It's a Buddhist idea that, you know, when a big cosmic cycle goes to destruction, all beings are being reborn in the Rupa Jhanas.
Right. I'm familiar with that, but let's just say I'm not buying it.
Well, then the idea of Buddha doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
We're not the case.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
We'll get to that.
Can we assume that the ability to get into the jhanas is not at all linked to the culture where it comes from or the interest in things like that? Can it happen to everyone? Is it universal?
I think that it's universal. That is, it's a human condition rather than a cultural condition. I say this because the jhanas show up in the Sufis. They're practicing them. Okay? Now, maybe they got them from India. You know, it's not that far from India to Persia, and there was a lot of trade through there. So maybe that's where they picked them up. But they're certainly there. And some of the Christian mystics describe them. So it seems to be the natural way the human mind goes rather than a cultural thing. And the fact that I was stumbling into the first and second jhana with absolutely no training other than to follow my breath, yeah, it seems to be human rather than cultural. But yeah, the whole thing on rebirth, yeah, we'll get to that.
How do you know when you see a nothing?
Mm-hmm. When you take the lid off the cookie jar and you look in and there's nothing in there, how do you know it's nothing?
If you don't have a cookie jar, you just see it.
When you first begin entering into the seventh, it's like right in front of you, there's nothing. There's no cookies, right? But when you look at the edge where the jar is, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. And you look at the bottom of the jar, there's nothing there. And so it just gets to be a bigger and bigger nothing. Every time you look for the edge of the nothing, there's nothing. It's hard to put it into words.
What is the benefit?
What is the benefit? The benefit of all of the jhanas is that they generate a mind that is concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, which you can then direct and incline to knowing and seeing. In other words, they give you a mind that is better able to see what's actually happening. They sharpen your insight practice. And being able to see what's actually happening gives you insight into the nature of reality, and having insight into the nature of reality, you can more easily act in harmony with reality instead of at cross purposes, and so doing reduces your dukkha.
Does that mean the perception of reality gets homogeneous? That suppose that you know everything about people if you want to, or if it has a purpose?
The things that basically become clearer to you are the inconstant, impermanent nature of reality, the fact that nothing is going to provide lasting satisfaction, and that everything depends on a whole bunch of other things. Nothing stands alone. That's really what you start seeing. That's the qualities. In Pali, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Okay, usually translated as impermanence, non-satisfactoriness, and not self. So that's what you start seeing is, yeah, things aren't as substantial as you thought they were. Which, you know.
What about yourself?
You start seeing that this idea of a self is an illusion, that it arises, I would say, due to the fact that, well, you got the universe here, and the universe pokes up an eyeball, right? Actually, there's two eyeballs looking around. Got little microphones on the side, right? Picking up the sounds. And furthermore, mobile. It's a mobile sensing device moving around on the surface of the universe, but it's just a piece of the universe. And then that mobile sensing device looks down and goes, me. But it's just a piece of the universe. So at the depths, what you see is that this sense of me as a separate entity is an illusion. That I am just a bunch of streams of dependently originated phenomena that are interacting. And I act and create more streams of dependently originated phenomena that interact with you and everything else. So, yeah, that's the way that I see that it goes. That's where the insights take you. I'll talk more about this, I promise.
Mm-hmm. Considering the recent discoveries about the brain's plasticity, neurons that fire together, wire together,
mm-hmm.
From what you described about the results, benefits of practice of the jhana, would it mean that if you do it often enough, neural pathways, the synaptic pathways we're creating, get better and better, faster and faster, and in time you're going to be a much wiser and less foolish person?
I don't know if the last part is right. Okay, so everything about the neuroplasticity and the neural pathways that produce the jhanas and all this sort of stuff, definitely, it gets better, it gets more accessible, and so forth. The jump to the wiser person probably occurs with the insights that you get, not just being in the jhanas. Okay? In other words, it's going to require that you take your concentrated mind and investigate reality and see the reality clear enough so that now the inconstant nature of reality begins to get wired into your system so that you're noticing it more. The lack of permanent satisfaction is seen clearer, and that gets wired in. And the fact that there's no independent entities becomes clear, and that gets wired in. So I don't think it goes from just having the jhanas to wisdom. It goes from the jhanas to investigating the reality and seeing it clearly. To wisdom.
That would explain or shed some light on the discussion. I remember having read about people saying, well, you know, these blokes have been meditating for decades and they still foul up their relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just because you can get quiet doesn't guarantee you're going to get the wisdom you need. You might just get quiet. You don't get any wisdom. So, yeah, meditation is no guarantee, even if you're quite good at it, that you're going to be wise. But it sure helps, right? You've got a much better chance to gain wisdom if you get your mind quiet and then investigate reality.
You move through them and then you say stop at 6 or something. Why should you stop at 6 if you want to, you know, study the body instead of 8? You know, how come you choose the different ones for realizing different things?
Okay, so why do you choose to stop at some place other than 8? Generally, I'll stop at 4 because I feel like, okay, I've got some good concentration. I want to use the rest of the time for insight practice. I don't want to spend the time getting to 8, right? It's like, okay, good enough, let's go. And I'm more interested in insight, actually, than concentration. But sometimes I go on to 5, 6. If I get to 5, I'm pretty likely to go to 6 and 7. And since 7 is my favorite, I'm going to hang out there for a while, right? It may be that I'm hanging out in 7 and it's like, okay, time to do some insight practice so I don't go to 8. But most of the time I'll go on to 8. And then I might come back to 7 and then do the insight practice. So I can't remember the last time I stopped at 6 other than the bell rang, you know, when I hadn't gotten to 7 or something like that. So I'm generally either stopping at 4 just because, like, all right, this is enough concentration. It's going to take a little while to get to 5, 6, 7, 8. I'd rather spend that time investigating reality. Or if I go on to 5, I do remember a time. I was on retreat with Powak, and after the long time in access, got the really deep 2, 3, 4, went to 5, very clear, went to 6. Oh, I haven't had 6 that deep in a long time. That may be the deepest I ever had it. Had a little, you know, consciousness here and there. Try to go to 7, but I can't get to 7 because I get a nimitta. I don't get the nothing. I'm just getting the nimitta that I'd been trying to get, you know, while I was doing the access concentration. And I can't find nothing. You know, all I can find is the nimitta. So then I tried to go to 8, but all I got was the nimitta. And so I went back to 6. And yeah, it was back to infinite consciousness and back to 5. And then I decided I'd had enough. So there was that one time when I couldn't find 7 because of the nimitta. So, but other than that, if I can get to 6, I'm probably going to 7 because I really like 7.
There seems to be some craving.
No, I wouldn't say craving as much as desire. You know, when I didn't get to 7, it was just like, huh, that's interesting, as opposed to being upset or anything. I didn't experience any dukkha from that. It was just like kind of interesting that I couldn't get 7, all I could get was a nimitta. Yeah, it's just
the feta.
What?
The feta of the arupa jhana is one of the last impurities to get rid of the in progress of enlightenment.
Right. Yeah, there are 10 fetters, and 5 go with the final stage, and 2 of them are, yeah, getting hung up on the jhanas, the rupa jhanas and the arupa jhanas.
What would that indicate on a practical level apart from actually desiring the jhanas themselves? You know, if you don't have a rupa jhana, what is the practical consequence of that?
Don't know.
Desire.
Yeah.
A desire for art, for formlessness of art, for music, or pure aesthetic pleasure?
Now, one of the things that Ayakema said was that it could be wanting to have things nice. Okay, so you just like to have things nice.
On a very aesthetic, refined aesthetic level.
Yeah, you're into
artistic appreciation.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that you're really kind of hooked on that.
Desire that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not just enjoy it, but also desire. I want it.
Right. Yeah, it's rupa chanda and arupa chanda. So desire for form, desire for formless.
That's
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll talk about the fetters later. We'll come back to this one. Okay, I think it's time for a short break and then metta.